Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. The next panel is the LNG and the maritime panel. If you look at the shipping MLP universe, it's fair to say that LNG transportation and regasification dominate the sector. And we're very happy today to have two of the best in class in our panel. I would like to introduce here to my right, Richard Tyrrell. He is the Chief Executive and Chief Financial Officer of HAG LNG Partners. HAG LNG Partners has ownership interests in five FSRUs. The company specializes in floating regasification. This is a publicly traded partnership that has a market cap of approximately $650 million. Andrew Oreker, he is the Chief Executive Officer of GasLog Partners. GasLog Partners owns nine LNG carriers. The company specializes in LNG transportation. GasLog Partners today has a market capitalization of approximately $950 million. And last but not least, we have with us Akif Irfan. He's the Vice President and a member of the Energy and Infrastructure team of Goldman Sachs Asset Management. Based on Goldman's regulatory disclosures, the company, Goldman Sachs, is active in the shipping MLP sector, and we are definitely looking forward to hear his views as an investor. With that being said, I would like to also introduce myself. My name is Lambros Papaikonomou. I am the U.S. correspondent for Lloyd's List. Lloyd's List, if not the most respected, at a minimum is the oldest global maritime publication. We are dating back to the 1700s. I am based here in New York, and my specialty is U.S. shipping capital markets. To get started, Andy, I would like to start with you and ask you to give me an assessment of what is the current state of the LNG market, specifically with prospects for demand growth.
Sure. Thank you, Lambros. You know, 2016 was a very interesting year in the LNG trade. I think we began the year with a thesis that a number of the large importing nation of all commodities, really, but including LNG, would struggle last year given challenging economic conditions. And in fact, just the opposite took place. So we saw about a 7% growth in the global trade of LNG in terms of the commodity. China and India leading the way with year-on-year increases of imports over 30%. And a number of new importing nations that companies like Richards have helped create new markets for LNG. And so places like Jordan, Pakistan, Egypt, Poland, taking larger and larger volumes than some for the first time or some than they ever have in the past. So the demand that I think was long questioned in response to a very significant supply growth in principally in Australia and the U.S., that began in 2016 is going to continue for many years to come. Demand was there to absorb the supply, and one can simply look at the commodity price for gas in both Europe and Asia and see its performance and see evidence of that continued strong demand. So the themes around LNG, many of you might know as the cleanest burning fossil fuel, one that is expected to continue to grow. The natural gas market is expected to continue to grow at a 1 to 2% rate for the next 15 years or so, with LNG roughly double that, so taking significant share from pipeline gas, and in fact perhaps overtaking pipeline gas by the end of the next decade. That theme still is very much alive as we speak to you here today. And then, of course, the shipping market, which is most relevant to our company as a pure play on LNG shipping at the MLP level, has also seen its own demand response and spot market rates increasing quite significantly through the balance of last year to where they sit today.
Thank you, Andy. Richard, you are at the end of the LNG supply chain. You provide the needed regasification. Can you tell us a little bit about demand prospects and growth prospects in that area?
Sure. This is a market which is starting to rebalance, but it is a little bit oversupplied. That's clear. But you know, of course, for everyone who might be disappointed by that, those who are more than happy, and the customers are more than happy. They see LNG now as being a very viable source of fuel. Are looking at it for all sorts of reasons, because not only is it viable from a cost point of view, it's also extremely flexible. You can bring on LNG relatively quickly. It can be used for things like air conditioning load in hot countries. It can be used as a means to secure supply in places where maybe they might have hydro, but if it doesn't rain, they need power. Or in the case of Lithuania, where they just simply want to have an alternative to the pipeline gas from the east. There's lots of reasons for why people might want to use LNG. The fact that it's now very cost competitive is extremely helpful from a customer point of view, and it's extremely helpful from our point of view because the customers need FSRUs in order to import the commodity. The business development pipeline is robust. It's moving forward. I wouldn't say in a particular area specifically, but we've got projects in Latin America, we've got projects in Europe, we've got projects in Africa, across the Indian subcontinent, and Asia. And it's it's as good as an environment from a business development point of view as we've seen.
Akif, when we look at the LNG supply chain, liquefaction, water transportation, regasification, and we try to think of drivers that would accelerate trade, and even more importantly, any potential bottlenecks that could slow down the trade, would you like to share your thoughts at this subject?
Sure, and before I begin a compliance disclosure, the views and opinions that I express today are my own and for informational purposes only and do not constitute a recommendation by GSAM for you to take any action. So as far as the value chain is concerned, as an MLP investor, the LNG space as a whole does screen as being quite interesting for some reasons. One is that the contract structures, regardless of the subsegment of the LNG space, do tend to be long-term contracts that can be a number of years in length, which tends to screen well for MLP vehicles. Now, as far as the different segments, you know, depending on the market that we are looking at, different segments may seem to have a bit of a higher return than others, depending on how tight the market is and how tight the long-term contracts that are available in the market tend to be. When looking at the LNG space as a whole, as Richard mentioned, it does seem as though there may be some oversupply of LNG. Now, how long that LNG oversupply exists and what the magnitude of that oversupply is, I think is, you know, up for question. You know, one interesting point recently, Shell issued its LNG outlook, which noted that LNG demand is set to rise 4 to 5% a year to 2030. Which is, you know, from a demand perspective, quite a positive number. So, you know, is there going to be demand that is available to soak up that supply? Possibly. But if there is an oversupply of LNG, you know, getting more demand channels such as FSRUs would be one way to eat into that oversupply.
Thank you, Akif.
Maybe I can say a word about the bottleneck.
Sure.
Question. I'll answer this in the sense of you know, what is slowing down the implementation of FSRU projects, because you know, I think the fundamentals, you know, genuinely are very strong. But there are a few things that do take time, and I don't think it's a technical matter on the whole. You know, our projects, if they're slowed down by anything, it's commercial, and that can be regulatory, in that sometimes these countries need to have a regulations in place that support the entry of gas, and sometimes the bottlenecks come from vested interests within the country. And yeah, some of this gas is not going to satisfy new demand for power. Some of it's going to be displacing coal. Some of it's going to be displacing oil and oil products. And you know, in some places, they are, you know, genuinely powerful vested interests that do try and slow down the march of LNG.
Thank you. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the two companies. You have somewhat similar business plans. You rely on your sponsor to acquire assets that have long-term cash flows. Can you please tell us a little more about the drop-down pipeline that you have, the backlog, excuse me, for assets to acquire? And if I may ask another question, how are you going to pay for these acquisitions?
Sure. So I'll go first. As Lambros mentioned, our Gaslog Partners today has 9 LNG carriers that we fully own under charters. In fact, they're all under charter to Royal Dutch Shell. And we have another 13 where we have rights of first offer, so effectively the right to acquire them from our parent, Gaslog Limited. And those are on charters ranging from the year 2020 to some as far out to 2029. And they're on charter to Shell, Total, and Centrica, who you may know as one of the largest utilities in the UK. So we've got about $170 million of EBITDA owned by the MLP today, and almost $300 million of EBITDA in that drop-down pipeline. So there's clearly a lot of growth ahead of us. We most recently raised capital in January. We raised about $80 million of new common equity, and that is more than sufficient for our next vessel drop-down. We typically finance ourselves roughly 50-50 between equity and debt, and sometimes we use a bit more debt, but generally try to be in that 50-55% debt to sort of book capital. Which, for those of you in the more mainstream MLP world, it translates to about 4 to 4.5 times debt to EBITDA, which I know is a common metric in the U.S. midstream. And so I think our unit price is up about 20% year to date, and we're trading at about an 8% yield. So while we think there's, given this very visible growth, we think there's a significant rationale for tightening of that yield further. You can ask Akif about the overall MLP market, but I think both Richard and our partnerships trade at a wider yield than the sort of average MLP, which I certainly have some views on. But I think as that yield continues to come in, the equity becomes more attractive relative to the cost of the projects or the ships that we're acquiring. And so we're hopeful that we're going to continue this capital market access we've had. But if the common market does step back again, I think you've seen a number of partnerships use preferred equity, both in terms of the perpetual preferred structure, which is effectively preferred for life that is its own stack in the capital structure, or convertible preferreds where you're able to issue common equity at a premium in the future. And both of those would be quite attractive. So we feel good about the options we have to fund our growth.
Richard?
Speaking for Höegh LNG Partners, from a funding point of view, we do have quite a lot to fund. We have three more vessels to drop down in the pipeline, so that'll take our fleet from 5 to 8. Those are awarded contracts, and there'll be more to come, judging by the business development pipeline. So we will have funding needs. I like to keep my options open. I think that's important. But I also have a preference for basically using a combination of the secured debt financing, which is very cost effective, and on the one hand, and common equity on the other.
So on the question of where the shipping names actually stand today relative to the rest of the MLP space, a few interesting points. So the Illyrian MLP Index, which is the index that tracks the MLP universe, if I were to compare that with the universe of MLP shipping names, and here what I'll look at is the constituents of, there's an index called the Yorkville MLP Marine Transportation Index. There's about 10 names that are part of that index. So if I were to compare the Illyrian MLP Index yield to what the median yield of that shipping universe was, the historical average from the launch of the Illyrian Index in 2006 until 2014, which is when the index, the Illyrian Index, reached its peak, the average spread between the marine median and the Illyrian Index was 1.5%. At the peak of the market in August 2014, that spread was 1%. At the trough of the market, which was February of 2016, just about a year ago, that spread widened to 6.4%. And where are we at today? It's back to 2.4%. So quite a bit of tightening versus the trough, but still not at historical levels, as Andy had mentioned.
You brought a very interesting question, point about the Illyrian Index. And to the best of my knowledge, shipping in MLPs in the Illyrian Index represent less than 1.5%. There are only 3 out of the 10 shipping MLPs that are part of the index. Based on your experience as an investor, is there evidence to support that if an MLP is part of a broad index that, like the Illyrian, that it achieves higher valuations?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think if you were to look more granularly at the way that the fund universe in the MLP space is structured, what you'd find is that the largest ETF in the space doesn't actually track the Illyrian MLP index. It tracks a sister index called the Illyrian MLP Infrastructure Index. And that index actually does not have any shipping constituents in it. So if a marine name were to be added, for example, to the Illyrian MLP index, the wider index, I don't know that there would be as much of a technical benefit to that shipping name than were it to be added to that AMZI index, if only because then you would have that additional passive vehicle adding to its ETF. Now, if the scope of the infrastructure index is such that a marine name could be added to it, then I think that one might see some technical benefit to that shipping name. But I suppose that one of the hurdles for that to occur is that, when you look at the methodology of these indices, they'll tend to have a liquidity float restriction or requirement. So, for example, one of the indices in the space will ask for a median amount of daily trading of about $2.5 million a day over a certain period of time. And if you looked at the marine shipping universe and looked at what the last year's turnover was per day, it's actually less than that. So I think it's a little bit circular, but the answer to your question is, if it's added to the right index, I think it could be technically beneficial to the shipping name. But in order to do so, I think that you might need to see a little bit more liquidity in the space. And I wonder if the scope of the index's methodology itself allows for shipping names to be considered infrastructure.
Andy, there is a trend. I mean, there is no question about that. There is a trend towards passive index-based investing. Is is the possibility, like Akif said, of being a component of that index something that is in the back of your mind? I mean, you know, your capitalization is closing, is nearing $1 billion. I mean, you are there, you are not still, you are not, you are almost there.
Right.
But is this something that that you look at strategically?
Very much so. I think we obviously want to appeal to as many different pockets of capital that find our story compelling. And that includes, of course, retail. It includes the institutional active managers that we primarily meet with. But any addition to index funds that are well followed is something that we're what's within our control. We're always seeking to pursue. You know, I find Akif's comments interesting because, as Lembros mentioned, we're now nearing about $1 billion in market cap. And since our last equity offering, we've seen a fairly sustained increase in our trading volume. I think we're in dollars trading about $5 or $6 million a day. And about a year ago, we were trading about one or two. So it's quite a big difference on not much more market cap. And so I'm hopeful that we're maybe able to start appealing to the category that you mentioned before. But it is hard for us to control, other than just keep executing our business plan, you know, raise equity responsibly, you get more units out there, and hopefully liquidity should follow, and we've seen that so far.
Richard, what are your thoughts?
We see the MLP market as having improved in terms of its depth quite significantly over the last few months. So maybe don't feel quite the same your need to be in an index today. However, you know, clearly the ambition of HMLP, as it is for most companies, is to grow, is to be a company which is going to qualify. Just like Andy said, you know, we do everything we can to take the steps to move in that direction.
I would like to ask you in the broader LNG sector, because right now what we're seeing companies that are trying to grow organically, if you like, acquiring assets from the sponsor. Is it a possibility that we can see M&A activity, and perhaps through an M&A activity we can see a combined entity that meets the criteria for market cap and trading liquidity? Is this something, is it a pipe dream, or is it something that could happen?
Well, I think on that question, you've kind of put your finger on it in terms of why you might do something of that nature. I think it would be more targeted at size, at being able to qualify for some of these things. It might help you with your cost of financing and so on. But where you aren't going to get a significant uplift from M&A activity in this space is on the sort of synergy side. This business runs with relatively low OPEX. So you can strip a little bit out of it, but it's not going to move the needle in terms of value. So, you know, there is going to be any M&A activity. I think it'll be driven by these sort of more technical factors than sort of pure fundamentals.
Andy, what are your views on that?
I would share those comments. I think the interesting part about the marine sector is that each of us have a slightly different strategy, but I think it's very much complementary to the overall LNG delivery value chain. And so I think there's growth in each segment. Our parent company now has one FSRU project in place, so we're quite small compared to Richard's, but we expect to be able to have that asset class available to the MLP and the MLP investor who might own GasLog Partners. And so I think the assets are in place for a very attractive growth story and a compelling MLP, and that we ought to just grow into our drop-down pipeline in size over time. So I don't think it would require a specific corporate transaction to achieve that. I think we'll get there on our own with continued execution of our strategy.
Thank you. I would like to again switch gears and perhaps touch upon one issue that is probably the most important to investors, and this has to do with the yield, with the distribution. 2016 was a good year for shipping MLPs, I would like to say. We did not have any MLP cutting the distribution, if you exclude one that doesn't pay any. But other than that, MLP, we saw obviously unit prices going up in tandem with the rise in crude oil prices. We saw two shipping MLPs that raised the distribution for the fourth quarter, and I believe that Castlelock Partners was one of them. Akif, what do you see happening in 2017? And I would also like to note that HAG LNG Partners, when they did the recent public offering, they also signaled a dividend increase starting with the first quarter of this year. Akif, what do you see in 2017 for the shipping MLP sector?
Sure. So I think that the shipping MLP sector reflects some of the same themes that we see in the broader MLP universe, and that's the distribution growth in 2017 is likely to be somewhat muted relative to longer-term historical averages. So if I were to look at the Bloomberg consensus distribution growth for the constituents of the Alerian MLP index for the next four quarters, I would find a median growth of about 4%. In the shipping space, it's about 1.3%. So, the average longer-term Alerian index distribution growth year over year was, call it, high single digits, maybe something in the 7 to 9% range. So across the space, you have many names who have either guided to maybe lower growth than the historical average, or the Bloomberg consensus is that there will be lower growth. And the shipping space is not unique in that. Also note that there are names within the shipping space that actually have, distribution growth that they could deliver that is above that, 4%. But the median is that 1% growth figure.
Andy, what say you about Gaslog Partners?
Well, as you mentioned, we grew our distribution by about 3% for the fourth quarter. And that was based on an acquisition that we did in the middle of the fourth quarter. So we'll have the full benefit of that acquisition here in the first quarter, and we plan to grow the distribution by another couple percent. And then we've now raised capital to fund another acquisition, as I mentioned, which should support us growing our distribution further. I think we've talked about this in our materials to $2.09 or higher by the end of the year on a run rate basis. So we've had this 10 to 15% compound annual growth rate target for our distribution. We came up with that formulation because we went public in the middle of the year. It's a bit confusing, but basically, to date, we've met that. We've delivered about 11% annually since the spring of 14, which, as Akif has mentioned, seems like an awfully long time ago. But we've been able to maintain that guidance, and we've affirmed it in every quarter since we've been public, which is something we're very proud of, and we think we can continue doing it for 2017. So it does feel like we're, relative to the statistics Akif mentioned, we're kind of above that median, and feel good about the prospects for further growth. I would say now it does feel like we're being rewarded for the growth in some sense. Last year, I think growing your distribution was seen as only creating a greater risk that you'd have to cut it. Now the pendulum maybe hasn't fully swung, but it does feel that companies like Richard's and ours that can grow their distributions will be rewarded for it in the valuation and unit price. And so it's certainly worth pursuing, and we're fortunate to have, a great deal of growth that's very visible.
I'd completely concur with what Andy's saying. Keith's numbers, I'm pleasantly surprised to hear them, because we're going to be able to, I think, beat that kind of growth by some margin. We did a drop down at the end of last year, which closed on the first of this year, which will enable us to increase the distribution for the first quarter by between 4 and 5%. That was sort of half a unit, so we've got the other half to come. subject to the usual caveats this year, and that'll have a comparable impact on distribution. So, add those two together, and we're comfortably beating those types of numbers, which Akif suggested as the average for the sector.
I would like to say that when it comes to raising the dividend, the problem is that investors get used to it, and. And another problem is that the more you raise, that's a nice problem to have, is the more you raise the dividend, the closer you get to the high split is when the IDRs get into play. I like to call the IDRs profit sharing. Obviously, you are not there yet, but there was a shipping MLP that adjusted the IDRs. Is this something that we should, not necessarily just for the shipping MLPs, but for the broader MLP sector, is it something that we should expect to have IDRs being reset as we are nearing the high splits?
I believe so. I think we've seen a lot of companies, once they've reached the 50% splits in particular, they've struggled to grow. I think the GPs have got to sort of decide how do they want to monetize their interest in the MLP. They basically you have a choice, and I do think the alignment of the IDRs is worth something. So I wouldn't want to see it go away entirely. But a GP can either monetize through the drop downs and the acquisition price, or they can wait for the cash flows to come via the IDRs. I don't think they're going to be able to monetize through both at the same time, and it's a trade-off. And for us, as a group, the former is, I think, more beneficial because we're a growth group. We need to recycle the capital to meet that growth up at the parent level. The MLP will benefit in due course, but it makes a lot more sense to do so through monetizing at the acquisition point rather than monetizing through the IDRs, which obviously comes in over time in the future.
Yeah, I would echo Richard's comments. I think the IDR discussion is one where, from what I've observed in a couple cycles now through the MLP market, is those who wait too long to address the problem often have fewer options and are forced with capitalizing a value for the IDRs that may not be palatable to the GP, may not be valuable for the LP. And so while we're only in the 25% tier today, it's something we have a very close eye on, because our value and pitch to gentlemen to my right is based on the growth we can deliver, and that growth will vary depending on our cost of capital. I think we have very attractive projects with a great runway of cash flow, but the IDR burden at higher costs of capital makes that growth more challenging for us or any MLP. And so I think the ability to reset the IDRs as one idea, or removing the 50% tier, can be quite compelling to keep outperforming the growth rates that Akif's mentioned. And typically, some markets of 16 didn't prove this to be the case, but higher growing MLPs are typically valued over the long term at tighter yields and have better costs of capital. And so that, as Richard put it well, that the general partner, I think, needs to decide if that's their objective, what's the best way to achieve it. In many cases, it's addressing the IDRs.
I would like to open the panel for questions from the audience. Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you. This question is for Andrew. You mentioned that when you're raising funds, you're doing half rights issue, half debt, and actually it goes further down the point to what you were talking about, the IDRs. I was just wondering, how are you structuring the debt side of those deals?
Sure. So we typically have two layers of debt in our capital structure. One is what you think of as a traditional mortgage debt or first lien, which has often been very attractive for us. In fact, we're seeing terms actually improve over time, even as the credit markets tightened up a bit. And so that's typically anywhere from 40% to, in some cases at our parent, that could be 60-70% sort of loan-to-value of the ship, plus the contract. Then we also have some junior debt in a couple different forms. Our parent has a couple of bonds in Norway, which are unsecured. We also have some second lien bank debt that is coming due in May of 2018, which we're working currently to refinance. And my guess is we'll refinance it with another unsecured piece. So we've seen good exposure to that and continued strong interest from the banks for the first lien side of it. I think in the LNG world, shipping world, excuse me, an LNG ship with real steel value and a contract to someone like Shell is actually quite an attractive debt financing if the LTV is appropriate. So we don't take it for granted, and we don't want to be arrogant, but it's something we're pleased to see the continued strong response for.
I would like to ask one question. It's about to be springtime. Baseball season is upon us. If you look at the LNG shipping market, are we at the bottom of the first inning? Are we at the top of the ninth inning? Where exactly are we, Akif?
For me or for Akif?
So the LNG shipping market in particular, or the shipping market?
LNG shipping.
LNG shipping, I think that, you know, if we're looking at the carrier market, you know, the last several quarters, maybe the last 2 years, have had some pretty depressed spot markets. You know, as that market continues to tighten, I think that that screens as being, you know, a better and better market, a better market to have spot carriers in, a better market to be recontracting, you know, charter vessels in. So I think we're pretty early innings in that story. I think Andy probably agree.
Yes, I would agree with that. And just one perspective on it is, if you think about the cost stack of what a producer or a trader needs to move LNG from, say, the U.S. to Europe or Asia, you know, LNG shipping rates at $40,000-$45,000 a day are about 50 cents an MMBTU. And even if they went all the way to triple digits, where they were not long ago, that cost only increases to, say, $1, $1.25 per M, depending on where the vessel's going. So when you compare that to the increased economics from the oil price even moving $5, the relative ability for shipping rates to increase is quite a bit higher. And so we think there's a lot of upside from here, particularly with a supportive commodity price environment.
And then on the FSRU side, I suppose, it's a market where we probably would expect interest for FSRU, new FSRU projects, to be quite high for a number of years. So perhaps maybe a healthier part of the market cycle, but maybe that persists for some period of time. Richard, will you agree?
Yeah, I don't think the FSRU business is a cyclical business.
I think when it comes to FSRU and LNG, we are lucky that we have many, many innings to play ahead of us. So we won't complain about time. This concludes this panel. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your attention.